I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Everybody is saying, I am Charlie Hebdo, but who is Charlie Hebdo? He's the obnoxious, appallingly funny foulmouth that France loved more than it knew, who took the chance that free expression was worth dying for. And dying, he wept with Muhammad and gently told the killers, all is forgiven. He was vulgar, noble, omnidirectionally offensive, blasphemous, sometimes savage, a raunchy little wise guy not fit to print, but strangely, as it turns out, he was something close to the secret soul of France. The martyrdom of Charlie Hebdo provokes a host of questions about power and ridicule, insult and injury. Try this one. Are not terror and the so-called war on terror both overdue for mockery? So we get busy this hour with Juan Cole at the University of Michigan, the faithful day-to-day online historian of the long war from 9/11 to Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and now Paris. Also with Arthur Goldhammer in our Boston studio, eminent translator of French language and spirit, our bridge to the culture of France. But first, who knew that France and Paris were feeling so down and divided long before the brazen massacre? We've recorded a lot of strong conversation with Parisians in the last few days. Two stand out, young women writers with passionate but different takes on the vast outpouring in Paris last Sunday. First up is Lila Azamzangane, born in Paris of Iranian parents with a sort of binocular vision of her country. She felt a state of grace in France last weekend.
It was extraordinary. It was incredibly civil and people were very peaceful. 1.5 million in the center of Paris. The center of Paris inside the walls, as they say, intramuros, is 3 million. So it's really half the city was in the street. It was impossible to get on a subway. But every time someone stepped on your foot, they apologized. It was, you know, a state of grace. I've never seen France that way. Never. You know, one of the big problems in France is that there is no hyphenated identity. And although the immigration has become increasingly, they're an increasingly strong percentage of the population, the typical Republican, what we call the ideal of the Republic, is very much liberté, égalité, fraternité. In reality, it's very different from the United States because you're equal insofar as you're like the Republic and preferably if you're completely French and you have to try and integrate. And for the first time yesterday, you had all kinds of people, and they had signs which said, I am Kurdish, I am Charlie, I am Jewish, I am Muslim, I am Charlie, I am Ahmed, I am Jewish, I am Ahmed, I am Charlie. And that was extraordinary. That's completely new. You looked around this crowd, and yes, there were, you know, typical French white people, but it was full of non-white people. And I've always felt that I belong to that idea of France, and that idea of France has existed in the real texture of the country, but it was never recognized officially. People don't like to talk about multiculturalism. It's completely different from the United States. I mean, if you think about it, Gallimard, our best publisher, has a collection called Black Continent. So they even publish black writers separately in a collection called Black Continent.
Mm.
Which is hilarious. Imagine that in America. Black Continent, really? And it looks kind of exotic. It's red, black, and it has funny African trees. And then we have a literature called Francophonie, which is of the French language but not French. And there's always a distinction when you come from the Francophonie. Although right now, I think they're some of the best writers that France has to offer. They're never considered really on par. But they're sort of caught up in a post-colonial thing where they're trying to mimic the U.S., but they're making gaffe after gaffe. So this was extraordinary. It was the first time I've ever seen the French like that in such a state. There's no other word. It was a state of grace. Everybody was saying, I'm Kurdish and I'm French, I'm Jewish, I'm French, and I'm here to defend the Republic, and this is what the Republic is about.
Unpack that Republic thing. What are we harking back to? Where does the ideal come from?
We had this ideal that was created and constructed really around the idea that France stands for values that are universal and not individual values. But the sense of universal is very different from what it is in America. Because when you're French, the universality of the French is something that's dictated by the French. You know, you can't wear the veil at school. You can't show in public spaces any external signs of religiosity. Like, we don't have "In God We Trust" on dollar bills. We're much more irreverent that way, and laïcité, we're truly, truly, truly secular state, to the point that it has to be enforced in ways that would be inconceivable in the United States. You become equal by becoming like the French. So the Frenchness itself is universality. What was forgotten in the meantime was that, well, some people just don't fit. Some people who live on this territory and slowly have become the lifeblood of this territory, they don't fit in the ideal. They don't fit in the French universal idea. It's a paradox, in a sense. And even when you are fully integrated, as I've been, I'm born in France, I speak French like a French woman. I went to the best public schools of this country, you know, paying $30 a year for college. And yet, even I never fit. And all of a sudden, people are coming out for the first time saying, you know, to hell with it. What John Stewart called team civilization. For the first time, they're saying French means civilization. It doesn't mean Franco-French or universally French, which has always been a paradox. And maybe the French can hold multiple identities. You know, I contain multitudes. It's something, it's American. It's
Walt Whitman.
Exactly. It's Walt Whitman, but it's not French at all. And yesterday, what happened for the first time is that this idea of France finally emerged. And everybody was celebrating it, including the white French people who always talk about being Français de souche, which means coming from the territory. And the language of the territory, of the terroir, of the land, has always been a bit the language of fascism as well. That's the roots of French fascism. That's what even Sarkozy was using in his speeches. He's always talking about Frenchness and the land being rooted. It's an old, old French idea that the land is connected to who we are. So our ancestors have to be here. The land is ours. And the true Frenchness is connected to the soil of France. It's not a political idea. Whereas when you talk to a lot of these guys around France, first of all, they're becoming the lifeblood of the nation. They're the future of France and certainly of Europe. And that's what came up yesterday. That's why it was remarkable.
That was Lila Azam Zangane. She wrote an acclaimed, very personal book on the aesthetics of the Lolita novelist Vladimir Nabokov. She called him the Enchanter. Our other witness from Paris is Julie Pecheur, a journalist who's lived 7 years in the States and was in New York on 9/11. She felt that she grasped the American moment in 2001, but she's still stumped by the Paris reactions this week.
I'm baffled by the picture in Paris. I don't recognize my people. It's like our infamous arrogance and critical mind have dissolved into raw emotions, just pure sadness.
French people looking vulnerable. That's news.
Absolutely. It's been a week now, and almost seasoned news anchors or politicians are still crying on TV.
Why?
Why? These cartoonists were ubiquitous. You'll see their drawings in several newspapers, not just Charlie Hebdo, and sometimes for over 50 years. One of the cartoonists who was killed was 80 years old. So everybody knew them. Their drawings were sometimes obscene, even I find them sexist, you know, brutal, but they were never racist or mean to, I would say, normal people. They were very mean to famous people and politicians. And they really treated all religions equally bad. I mean, it was not just about Islam. And whether or not you liked their drawings, they really embodied something of the French soul. There is this century-old tradition of satirical cartoons, so free speech, and irreverence, which is, I think, the key adjective to talk about Charlie Hebdo, and secularism, which is very, very strong in this country.
Julie, set the context in France, in Paris, these days. We're told France is in trouble.
France is going through a major crisis. I mean, has been going through a major crisis for years now. The economy is worrying with huge unemployment. But there's also a deep identity crisis. Decades ago, people started to wonder what it meant to be French in a global world, but also with rising minorities within the country, France is having a very hard time making space for its immigrants and for their children. Mm. You now have the extreme right lurking in the background. So this thing of defining identity has been going on for quite a few years, and it's not very healthy. I don't know if you've been to Paris recently, but you can very feel in the streets how harsh the atmosphere has become. In the metro, in taking the bus, like people are addressing each other in a very harsh manner. And you'll notice that French people don't look happy.
What did you see on Sunday?
Well, there were 4 million people in the streets, and I saw that in Paris. It was extremely impressive. Very silent demonstrations. And people were there to defend free speech and our values, but I had the feeling there was also something else happening. You know, there was like an urgent need to change that atmosphere we were just talking about. And it sounds terribly cheesy, but I felt the French were like everybody else after all. They needed love and warmth. I mean, we'll see how long that lasts, but there was something about that, of wanting things to change. And a general fed up with the political tension in this country, especially around the idea of the French identity, and with the extreme right rising in the polls and in the elections every time. France is having a very hard time embracing its immigrants and their children. There was just one moment in 1998 when France won the World Cup, and there was like 1.5 million people in the streets there. It's the previous record, just before the one on Sunday. So because the team was made up of French blacks, French Arabs, and white French, some people wanted to believe that that was the true face of France and that everybody was going to accept that. Again, this was in 1998. But then you had sons of Moroccans and Algerian immigrants, French kids, who started whistling over the French anthem during other soccer games between Algeria and France. And that was like the awakening. And then you had the riots in the suburbs, many riots over several years.
05, 06.
Yeah, 07. And now you have this. So France is in a dire situation, and politics have failed consistently for about 30 years to include this whole chunk of the French population. And, you know, this new tragic event is bringing all this up again. For now, the extreme right has shut up. There are new talk about changes in the banlieue, where a lot of these immigrants and their descendants are living. But we'll see what happens. I'm not very optimistic.
Is your mood today different from your mood yesterday?
Well, I've stopped crying 2-3 days ago. No, 1 day ago. Yeah, I've stopped crying. I've started thinking again. I'm very proud of the way people reacted so far. And now I'm waiting in angst to see how all this is going to translate into politics and international politics. We'll see.
That was Julie Pecheur, a freelance French journalist in Paris. Coming up, the outrageous commentary from cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo in a peculiar French tradition that is quite unlike our own, for better or for worse. This is Open Source. Peeping through several angles of hindsight on the massacre last week at the satirical sheet Charlie Hebdo in Paris, 12 people killed by two gunmen, both of them born in France, of Algerian stock, under the direction, it's now said, of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Our guests this hour are Juan Cole at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's the Middle East historian who's been blogging his commentary and analysis of the war on terror since 2002, and the translator of all matters French, including the Thomas Piketty bestseller last year on capital in the 21st century. That is Arthur Goldhammer in our studio. Could I ask you both, starting with you, Juan, to begin with the very general premise that France is now leading the world through its version of the American experience on September 11th, 2001, 12 and a half years ago. Is it like? Is it unlike? Is it parallel? Is it perpendicular? Start where you will. Juan Cole, welcome.
Hi, Chris. Well, I think that there's, you know, you can always compare and contrast. This was a very major event in the French psyche and French culture. I think it will have a big impact on France. But, you know, in the United States, there's a sense in which the September 11th attacks were taken advantage of, quite frankly, by Washington elites to pursue projects that they already had in mind, like invading and occupying Iraq, throwing the country into years of foreign wars and adventures, and a turn to what Dick Cheney admitted was the dark side with torture and so forth. And I just think that the French, certainly under Hollande, are very unlikely to react in that particular way. That is to say, September 11th becomes a really big thing in American history if you consider its aftermath. I think in France, this is a much more likely to be a much more limited event in the sense I don't think it redoes France in the way that September 11th arguably redid the United States.
But connected with the other events in the so-called war on terror, one call, including Afghanistan and ISIS in Syria and Iraq, Yemen, the direction of all of this or not. I mean, it is part of a bigger picture.
Well, it is, although it's very difficult to know exactly how. That is to say, these poor young men who are frankly petty criminals seem to have gotten all head up about the Iraq War. From the point of view of the undertrodden in the world, the Iraq War was not a wonderful shock and awe attempt by the United States to democratize the Middle East. It was an atrocity. It was greedy. It was for oil, and it involved bombing and killing very large numbers of noncombatants and innocent people. The U.S. bombed Iraq pretty intensively for 8.5 years. So it according to their self-report, Sharif Kawashi said that he became angry and radical on seeing the images of the torture from Abu Ghraib and the American actions in Iraq. Obviously, he had interpreters around him and recruiters who were putting a certain gloss on it. So there is a sense in which the pathological American reaction to September 11th set in train certain phenomena that maybe now have come back on France.
Arthur Goldhammer, you're our France guy. Do you buy that sort of locating it as a French event?
Well, I would like to raise the question why this event had the tremendous impact in France that your first interviewees described.
The women from Paris.
Okay. The women from Paris. Because we can understand readily why 9/11 had such a dramatic impact on the United States. The United States considered itself invulnerable in its own territory. It was separated from the rest of the world by oceans. Since 1812, it had not been attacked on its own soil. France has had numerous terrorist attacks. It's connected to the Middle East by land. It has a large immigrant population. So why it shouldn't have been France is familiar with being invaded. So why this tremendous reaction that the observers in Paris rightly report? And I would say because the French fear that they have now living within their own walls, within their midst, a population that is not assimilating in the way that they have become accustomed to, a population that does not respond to the supposed universal appeal, to use the word that the first woman who spoke,
Lila, yes.
Used, who are resisting this supposed universal appeal and are insisting on maintaining aspects of their own traditions and their own religion in particular. So for the French, this is an internal threat. An internal threat compounded by something that you haven't seen in the United States, which is the convergence of jihadi ideology with petty criminality. I think it's the idea that these toughs from the very tough and disaffected suburbs that exist around a number of French cities, young men who have no truck with authority in France, I think it's the fact that these people are the ones who perpetrated this, people of whom Français de souche have been afraid, of the Franco-French Frenchmen have been afraid for many years, who are now bringing home an ideology that is foreign. So it's the convergence of these two things, the foreign influence and the internal criminality that I think is responsible for the great fear.
But Lila was also speaking about a sort of maybe therapeutic meltdown of that French arrogance, a readiness to become a different sort of country. Now, that may have been a moment's romance or not. What do you think?
Well, I recognize that there was a new spirit expressed on the streets of Paris on Sunday, and not just in Paris, but all around France. However, I'm a man of little faith when it comes to these great Republican masses, because we've seen a number of them. The events around the victory in the World Cup were mentioned, but we've seen other moments of great Republican unity in 1980, or great expressions of popular solidarity in the streets. In 1981, when Mitterrand was elected, at the same place where this great demonstration in Paris took place on Sunday, the Place de la République, you saw people dancing in the streets. In 2002, when 80% of the population voted in the second round for Chirac as a rejection of Le Pen and the National Front, rejection of xenophobia, you saw again this expression of great national unity. Neither of these moments lasted for very long, and I'm afraid that France is soon going to fall back into the bickering that and hostility between rival parties that have characterized the crisis to this point.
Juan Cole, I wonder how you would set this event, French as it is, or otherwise, in the general context of Islamophobia in the world, even in the States, but certainly in Europe, where every country now has a right-wing nationalist or anti-immigrant politics, and this thing falls right into the scheme.
Yes, well, you know, Europe is facing severe demographic challenges. The older, I don't know what, the Christian and secular populations, let us say, of Europe just don't seem very interested in having children, or very many of them. We're expecting Germany to shrink from 80 million to 60 million by 2050. And of course, that has implications. It won't be the world's fourth largest economy any longer if that happens. And by the way, the same things are happening to Japan. And even in the United States, probably the older Northern European population in the United States has about a zero population growth. So, you know, you could just accept that, but then who's going to pay into Social Security and so forth? And the French government has been relatively proactive in allowing immigration as a solution to this problem, and has been rewarded because it's got a relatively dynamic society and economy in European terms. It's 66 million now. It had been 62. And it's not shrinking the way Germany has. But if you're going to solve this demographic problem and this and the problem of Social Security and how you take care of a large number of old and ailing people and so forth by immigration, then you're just not going to be the same country after a while. You're going to have to find some framework of multiculturality to deal with this. And in a way, Europe, if it's going to go in that direction, has to become more like the United States, where has U.S. has experienced successive waves of immigration, and we don't think it's strange. There are some people who don't like it at any one time and who are prejudiced against the particular groups that are coming in, but in the U.S., it's just understood that the country is always changing in this way. And the alternative to that is just to shrink and become much less important.
Not that we've solved our minority problems entirely either. But I'd like to ask you both, though, a question that I put this week to Adam Schatz, who's an American contributor to the London Review of Books, often dealing with the Middle East. I asked him, what's the chance in this Charlie Hebdo moment to deal with the evidence that the U.S. war on terror has simply not worked, neither the drone war? Al-Qaeda has been decapitated over and over again, and it's more lethal in more places than ever. I asked Adam Schatz, is France the place to start over?
Chris, I think it would be very naive to suggest that a project of expansive integration and enfranchisement in France is going to eliminate what is, in some respects, a transnational problem. I think we have to be very sober about this. Radical Islamism is a political force in our time. There are many reasons for it. This is a story that we've been involved in as well. I think the real game changer is the war in Iraq in 2003 and the dismantling of the Iraqi state and the policies of de-Ba'athification. That opened up a Pandora's box. Of course, there are other ways in which we have thrown oil on the fire. For example, our unconditional support of the state of Israel, our bankrolling of the occupation. So yes, we have to recognize that we are all a part of this story. It's not simply about the need to protect Western democracies against a threat which is outside. We have to see the ways in which these stories are intertwined.
That was Adam Schatz of the London Review. The Newt Gingrich version of the question and the answer is in the Wall Street Journal today. His view was, we are losing the war against radical Islam. One call.
Well, you know, the people like Newt Gingrich just essentialize Muslims, and that's a form of racism, in my view. So whether the war on terror is being won or not, you know, wars on things like terror and drugs and are never won. They're always rhetorical devices that politicians put forward to get elected or to make money or something. There is no analytical framework within which we could do social science to tell whether the war on terror is being won. It's a war on a technique. Turkey had a bombing a week ago, which almost nobody here paid attention to. It was quite horrible, actually. I think it killed one or two people, but it was done by a far left group. Terror is deployed by lots of different groups, and in fact, in Europe, the far left still commits more terrorism, much more than the Muslims. And left and far right terrorism in Europe in the recent years, according to Interpol, has been the bulk of it. Only 3% of attacks were conducted by Muslims. So, having a war on terror, if you really meant terrorism, is a war on a tactic that dissatisfied groups deploy, and it doesn't make any sense to talk about it in those terms. In fact, I'm very disappointed that the French Prime Minister
now
talked about a war on terror because, you know, Jacques Chirac really didn't do anything as president. There's a film about this. You couldn't name a single achievement, but he did have the virtue of calling up George W. Bush and saying, don't call it a war on terror.
And we won't be there. But Arthur Goldhammer, what did the prime minister mean about a new war on terror?
I would like to go back to the question you raised about whether France will repeat the mistakes that the United States made. One would hope that some lessons would have been learned, but the initial signs are not good. Hollande had been in a very deep hole. His popularity was at 13%, the lowest ever recorded in the history of the Fifth Republic. Mm. And his instinctive reaction to this event has been to follow the same course that the American president followed. He even went to an aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, which is being dispatched to the Middle East, and was received on the deck by the commander of that aircraft carrier, just as George Bush was. He made a very aggressive statement about and the prime minister reinforced this by using the terminology of war on terror. There has already been talk about tightening surveillance in an NSA-style manner in France. This morning, Le Monde had an interview with the head of the French equivalent of the NSA, saying that He thinks that counterpowers need to be in place because he doesn't want to be in the position of being the one to make the decisions to violate privacy. He wants to have some oversight placed on him. But there are a few other voices in France calling for oversight. Most are calling for extended surveillance of French citizens because it's known that Koulibaly and the Kouachi brothers communicated using their girlfriends' phones.
Right.
So even though their phones were being monitored, their girlfriends weren't. Presumably, if you had an NSA-style monitoring, that information would have come out. So there are lots of calls in France for tightening up, cracking down, restructuring the prisons, because radicalization of these perpetrators was known to occur in the prisons.
But I want to ask Juan Cole, what's the chance that either Frenchmen or Americans, for that matter, Brits or anybody else, has had the time by now to think of a better way forward on the whole Muslim so-called terror front?
Well, if we're talking about a combating of radical Islam, and radical Islam, you know, Islam is on a spectrum, so the vast majority of Muslims and forms of religious practice and belief are not radical, but there are radicals. In a way, you know, this is nothing new. Algeria fought a massive civil war all through the 1990s, which for some reason escaped most American observers, between relatively secular state oil elites in the capital and Muslim extremists, some of them hooked up with bin Laden and al-Qaeda, in which you see lots of estimates, but as many probably as 150,000 people died, and in which I guarantee you the French were very active behind the scenes in supporting the secularists, and the Algerian government won that one, and you know, it's not as if the Algerian fundamentalists don't know France's role in this area.
We're pulling on a lot of threads in the aftermath of the terrorist attack on Charlie Hebdo, the satirical weekly in Paris. Our guests are calling it a French event more than an international global event, but who's to say? Coming up, cycles of violence, terror, and wars on terror extending themselves, the directions they take, how those cycles get broken. This is Open Source. In the wake of the Charlie Hebdo shock in Paris, where do we rank the provocation in the pages of Charlie Hebdo itself? The famously crude caricatures of power in general, and Mohammed in particular. The killers in Paris shouted that they were avenging the Prophet, forcing all of us to think hard again about satire and savagery. As everybody knows by now, Charlie Hebdo practices a distinctly French style of attack that's quite unlike the verbal cartooning of, say, Saturday Night Live or Jon Stewart or the polite drawings in the New Yorker magazine. A French-American musician we know, Alain Pakowski from Biarritz, he's an authority on French literature and American jazz. He spelled out for us the bawdy and beautiful code of cartooning in France, with literary models back to Rabelais in the 16th century and probably further.
Okay, so if we speak first about particularly these guys, Cabu, Wolinski, Charb, a lot of them are as a result of the 70s, they came out really strongly in the 70s, they were younger then, and they were cartoonists which didn't do just political cartoons, they did all types of cartoons. And it was cartoons which look at life, basically, and the idea was to bring a comic counterpoint on actuality, on the news, and part of that comic counterpoint was usually to take a stab at, in an ironic way, at some of the issues, at some of the people, at the hypocrisy of people. And in that, on that instance, they situated themselves in a lineage, in a long, long lineage of French humor, criticism, sarcasm, irony, which goes back, I would say, to even the 12th century, for what I know. And what they loved is to joke over on what's taboo. Tasteless, but never hateful.
Interesting. I'm coming to think we miss it terribly in this country. We've missed it all through the George W. Bush years. You know, the American protest was all in bumper stickers, like, there's a village in Texas missing its idiot. There were a lot of nasty jokes about George W. Bush, but none of them
funny
made the papers.
And they were not always funny.
But they didn't get to the tragedy, the wreckage that he was piling up either.
For me, an analogy in the U.S., in a way, would be, imagine if George Carlin would have been a cartoonist.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it would be. Imagine if Richard
Richard... tougher than John Stewart in a way.
Right. Oh, yeah. Imagine if Richard Pryor had been a cartoonist. You see, that's what we are really speaking about. So again, in order to understand that, you have to understand the l'esprit français, the French spirit, and that, again, somehow that history of humor in France, which dates really from the 12th century. It's really come from that. America doesn't have that that legacy in a way.
From afar, one senses that France, even that massive crowd on Sunday, is learning something about just how deep this runs in their own contentment. It's a constitutional place in French culture to have this sort of squalling, obnoxious little brat sticking his tongue out at everything.
And it goes also with the bon vivant. It goes with liking good food. It goes with enjoying wine. It goes about celebrating life. Laughter is maybe it's like free thought. It's something which is so internal. We have the right to laugh. We have the right to think. It goes together. So it's the opposite of hatred. It's a fresh critique. It's a breath of fresh air.
That was Alain Pakowski, an American cartoonist on the edge. Michael Kupperman observed to us this week that it's not France that's got the free expression problem. It's us.
I mean, that was one of my first emotional reactions to the news from France this last week was a tiny bit of envy and respect that they really still stand up for the First Amendment over there, whereas here I think it's just been buried and kind of forgotten about. I think a publisher would rather do anything in America than stand up for the freedom of the press. There's such a timidity about printing anything that's going to offend anyone, even just anything that will invite any kind of legal attention whatsoever. A lot of people this week, their reaction to what happened in France is to go, well, I will defend someone's right to make their expressions of free speech, although now I've seen those images, ugh, I don't want to defend those. And I would say that freedom of speech includes not only the most offensive language, but the most frivolous as well. And if you don't stand up for any of it, then you're not standing up for all of it. Look at how, you know, gun people stand up for the Second Amendment. I'm jealous. You know, they really take it seriously.
Certainly post 9/11, there has been an incredible speak no evil, see no evil in the American established media.
Right. Well, what I think is that it's actually part of print obviating itself.
Yeah.
That by emasculating itself in this way, it's leaving itself unable to compete with the internet, where freedom of speech is an absolute. It's like a physical law, water finding its own level. There will always be freedom of speech as long as there's an internet. In print, you know, they can cover themselves in all kinds of ways. It's just another way of making themselves irrelevant.
Michael, what do you think drove the assassins in Paris to take out the cartoonists of all people?
Well, because I think they had made a specific gesture of defiance, and it was a point of theirs to answer that. They had essentially painted a target on themselves. They had said, we are going to continue provoking you. We know you don't like it, but we're going to continue. In a way, they were illustrating the principle of free speech, because they were creating images that a lot of people find so offensive, they don't want to look at them. But they were illustrating that they have a right to do that.
That was the cartoonist Michael Kupperman. You will find his very funny images on the web. Juan Cole in Michigan, Arthur Goldhammer in Boston. Did you hesitate about saying, I am Charlie, a week ago? For all these reasons of offensiveness, Arthur?
Yes, I hesitated. But I would like to join in the celebration of freewheeling, scabrous, uninhibited political humor. However, the notion that France has a more robust attitude toward free speech than the United States, I think, has to be qualified seriously. Even at Charlie Hebdo, there was a cartoonist who worked for Charlie Hebdo named Ciné, who did not draw a cartoon, but who made a remark when Sarkozy's son married the daughter of a wealthy Jewish businessman. He made the remark in the newspaper, in the magazine, Charlie Hebdo, that boy will go far. And as a result of that, he lost his job because that remark was taken to be anti-Semitic. And Charlie Hebdo wanted, despite its uninhibited relation to many other targets in France, It was not willing under the leadership of Philippe Val, who was later appointed to an important post in as head of a radio network by Sarkozy, the man whose son he defended. He fired Siné. So I think we have to bear in mind that France has its own forms of limitation on free speech. We saw that yesterday when France arrested 54 people for the crime of apology for terrorism, which is illegal in French law.
And what had they done?
They had expressed on social networks solidarity with the killers or understanding of the killers. Dieudonné, the anti-Semitic comedian, someone whose position I revile, made the statement on Facebook that je suis Charlie Koulibaly. Koulibaly is one of the killers.
Right.
Now, was that an apology for terrorism or an expression of understanding for the motives that might have moved this man to do what he did? I think it's quite a stretch. And in the United States, that would be protected speech. In France, it's a crime. So the idea that France is more uninhibited in this respect, I think, has to be seriously qualified.
Juan Cole, what about the overall tilt, it is said, anti-Islam in Charlie Hebdo?
Well, there isn't any doubt about it. I mean, they reprinted that Danish caricature that showed the Prophet Muhammad with a hooked nose and a ticking bomb in his turban. And the idea, you know, of Semites as having large noses and being emotional and irrational and undependable and maybe traitors has a very smelly, genealogy in European histories of caricature. And these things used to be done to the Jews. And in many ways, some of the kinds of caricatures that are done of Islam and Muslims in not just Charlie Hebdo, but widely in European society, really play on tropes that are familiar from the 20s and 30s, and I think are objectionable.
So you don't say, I am Charlie?
Well, I do say I am Charlie because I don't agree with everything that they did or said, but they didn't. They shouldn't have been killed. They should have the freedom to say it. They should have the freedom to be offensive. I'm realistic that, in the old days in the United States, when you had that big wave of Catholic immigration in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then the Protestants became alarmed and cut it off in 1924, even after that, when the film industry got really big, they wanted Catholics not to be offended. They wanted the priests not to declare the films to be immoral. And so they actually allowed the Catholic hierarchy in the United States to more or less censor their films for a long time. So I think in the real world, you're dealing with real people, often the market will dictate to you that you don't go too far in certain directions. And I think now in a globalizing world, one of the problems is that a publication or a film or whatever doesn't just have a local audience anymore. It's global. And if you're provocative in certain ways, you're offending people who don't share your traditions and can't interface with you and of whom you're not afraid, either market-wise or ideologically, and that this is a new situation. It is a global world in which, and we saw this with the interview about North Korea as well. It these things can cause a lot of problems.
Juan Cole and Arthur Goldhammer, come back to the big picture question about Europe and its sort of post-colonial blues, post-imperial afflictions with minorities and with integration. How is France about to deal with what seems here, Arthur Goldhammer, a complicated history?
It is indeed a complicated history. The colonial legacy plays into this in a very big way. As I said earlier, France treated the Muslim population in its colonies very differently from the Europeans who lived in Algeria. There were separate law courts for the Muslims, for example. There was no freedom of the press, little freedom of speech and political expression. That resentment has been carried over into France, and many Muslims feel that they live as a colonial people within the territorial boundaries of France itself. There's no doubt that there are extremely disaffected communities in France, places where crime is rampant, where gangs are running free, where gang leaders are really in control of the town and its politics, and where police are reluctant to go. I think you're going to see crackdowns on those places now, places that the police had avoided, places like Villiers-le-Bel, where there was a riot a few years ago. And when the police attempted to go into the town, they were attacked with automatic weapons. The response was that the police stopped going to that place. Now, however, that the automatic weapons have been used in the way that we've seen, there is going to be strong pressure to go after them. France will attempt to step up its efforts to integrate the Muslim population. However, I think it's important to say that integration of Muslims has not been a total failure in France. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it's been quite successful. The Muslim population is only 8%. It's overrepresented in the traditional institutions of socialization, such as the army and the bureaucracy. Muslims do graduate in substantial numbers from schools, and when they do, they can find jobs with more difficulty than native-born Frenchmen, but still Muslims are being integrated. So I would compare the situation to the situation in the United States when we were at the depths of our civil rights struggle. That's where they are now. They have something equivalent to our Black Power movement, which is causing a great deal of fear. But it's a problem that may be soluble. We'll see what the political response is.
One call, I'd love you to tear and compare once again the threats of Islamic radicalism coming out of the ISIS neighborhood, roughly, and another variety that's being incubated in French prisons. And how do we hold these things in our head together?
Well, I just want to underline that the Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, and including ISIS, are strategic creatures. They're political. They want to control territory. They want to reach out and have constituents. And one of their tactics is what the Leninists called heightening or sharpening of contradictions. They deliberately attack soft targets in hopes of provoking a backlash. And they did this in Iraq. They attacked Shiite weddings, funerals, ice cream shops where children were getting a snack, in hopes that the Shiites would then conduct reprisals against Sunni Arabs, which they did. And indeed, many Sunni Arabs in Baghdad were ethnically cleansed. And then Al-Qaeda can turn to the Sunni Arabs who have been discriminated against or displaced or harmed and say, well, you need a protector. And here we are. We can protect you. And this is what they did in June in Mosul in Iraq, and they've done in Syria as well. And so where they have acolytes in places like France, they want to do the same thing. They don't, you know, the situation that our great Arthur Goldhammer explained in France, they don't want that. They don't want integration. They don't want the Muslims to be more and more satisfied with being French. They want to provoke a kind of civil war, just as they did between the Sunnis and the Shiites in Iraq. And it's very important that the French not fall for this, that they not swing towards Marine Le Pen and the National Front in reaction to these events, because if they do that, then they'll be playing right into Al-Qaeda's hands.
On call, Arthur Goldhammer, I cannot thank you enough. I want to thank also Lila Azam Zangane in Paris and Julie Pecheur, Michael Kupperman in this country, Adam Schatz, and our friend, sort of radio cartoonist, Ben Walker. There's more on our website, comics, all sorts of extra credit reading at radioopensource.org. We're going out on the tune Aux Armes etc. by Serge Gainsbourg. Our show was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with special assistance from Kunal Jasti. Mary McGrath is our very own Charlie. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Entendez-vous dans les campagnes, rugir ces féroces soldats. Ils viennent.